Picture this, if you will. You're working in an urgent care center in the era of the COVID-19 pandemic. Using a video conferencing platform, you interview an otherwise healthy 25-year-old male who complains of 4 days of fever, dry cough, and fatigue. Oddly enough, he says, he was barely able to taste his breakfast this morning. Vitals are notable for a fever of 102.4, oxygen saturation of 94% on room air, and a respiratory rate of 22 breaths per minute. Over the live video feed, you notice that while the patient pauses to cough at least once a minute and appears to be breathing faster than normal, he doesn't appear to be in any real respiratory distress. Before you can tell him your recommendations, the patient begins nervously. I can't afford to be sick right now. I missed too many months of work when things were shut down, and they've fired people for less at my warehouse. He pauses. You don't think I have the COVID, do you? You consider how to address your patient's concerns, both medical and psychosocial. And welcome to AudioBricks. I'm Arjun Iyer, here to bring topics from pulmonology from our bricks to your ears. After completing this section, you'll be able to 1. Define COVID-19 and describe its epidemiology. 2. Define the viral characteristics of COVID-19. 3. Discuss the risk factors for severe COVID-19. 4. Describe the diagnostic workup for a patient with COVID-19. And 5. Discuss the current management of COVID-19 and the public health strategies to help stop its spread. So unless you've been living under a rock, you've all heard about COVID-19, the ongoing pandemic with arguably the greatest impact on healthcare systems, global and local economies, and geopolitics in living memory. Unfortunately, the timeline of COVID-19 has intersected with a number of cultural and technological phenomena that have made it easy for misinformation and conspiracy theories to take hold over facts and common sense. Now, I don't know about all of you, but I believe that part of our duty as those working in or training for healthcare fields is to at least understand the basics of what we know for sure about the pandemic and use our knowledge to help lead by example and fight against misinformation wherever we see it. You heard me. This is a difference you can start making now. At the same time, we gotta exhibit some scientific humility about what we don't know and what we think we know. Out of necessity, medical knowledge is evolving pretty fast around this topic. I'm recording this episode at the beginning of September 2020, and I'm going to keep this up to date as possible, but this is mostly intended to be a primer on the essentials of COVID-19 and the facts that we can at least be pretty confident about. Part 1. What is COVID-19? First off, let's start with terminology. The name COVID-19 is an abbreviation of the term Coronavirus Disease 2019. It's caused by a specific coronavirus strain called SARS-CoV-2. Now, coronaviruses, like influenza viruses, are found in many parts of the animal kingdom. If a bat coronavirus, for example, evolves the ability to infect humans, that's how epidemic and pandemic strains tend to happen. It's like smallpox to the Native Americans. Our bodies look at that weird bat virus and basically freak out and have no idea what to do with it. In the case of COVID-19, crossover to humans is believed to have occurred in late 2019 in a livestock market in Wuhan, China, possibly by way of bats, pangolins, or a civet cat vector. Now, this is one of the areas of speculation most rife with conspiracy theories, mostly because people have never personally experienced a pandemic quite this disruptive. So, obviously, it has to be a bioweapon or 5G or something else silly, right? But really, epidemics and pandemics happen all the time by similar mechanisms to the one I described, just on different scales. And ultimately, who cares? If people get sick, we treat them, no matter where the disease came from. At the start of September 2020, the facts according to the World Health Organization and Center for Disease Control, which are probably the most reliable sources of information, are this. More than 24 million people have been diagnosed with COVID-19 worldwide, and more than 800,000 people have died from it. In absolute terms, the country with the highest number of cases is the United States. However, there are more cases per capita in multiple countries in South America and the Arabian Peninsula, and more deaths per capita in many European countries that, like New York, were hit hard early on in the pandemic before widespread testing was available. Part 2. How do patients with COVID-19 present? COVID-19 is a viral infection that primarily affects the upper respiratory tract. After a person becomes infected with SARS-CoV-2, they generally remain asymptomatic for about 5 days, but may still be contagious. Which really sucks because asymptomatic carriers who feel well often still go about their daily routine and may not be as careful about infection control, spreading disease like little typhoid Marys in their schools, factories, and other densely populated areas. About 40% remain asymptomatic or have subclinical disease like feeling non-specifically crummy. Symptomatic patients initially present with a flu-like illness, for the most part indistinguishable from the common cold. The most common symptoms are cough, fever, myalgias, and headache. And like with influenza patients can also present primarily with gastrointestinal symptoms like nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and abdominal pain. Now, these are the most sensitive symptoms for COVID-19, but obviously none of them is very specific. One telltale feature is the loss of smell and or taste, because it's one of the only early symptoms that's pretty unique to COVID-19. Unfortunately, this is only found in a minority of patients, so it's specific, but not sensitive. But the feature of COVID-19 that's of greatest concern is that, like influenza, some patients may develop a lower respiratory tract infection in addition to the upper respiratory stuff. In other words, instead of the common cold, you're now dealing with a viral pneumonia. These patients typically present with shortness of breath and hypoxia, and like in that movie The Ring, this typically strikes around 7 days after the onset of symptoms. Spooky. Many of these patients will become hypoxic, and some may progress to acute respiratory distress syndrome, or ARDS. In critically ill patients, you have to worry about the development of respiratory failure, septic shock, and multi-organ dysfunction. You can also develop cardiomyopathy, like with the Coxsackie viruses, but one of the complications that makes COVID-19 stand out, amongst other viruses, is the prevalence of thromboembolic disease. Deep venous thrombosis, pulmonary embolism, myocardial infarction, and stroke are all alarmingly prevalent in this patient population, and pulmonary embolism specifically can cause rapid, unrecognized respiratory decompensation that many people will simply attribute to pneumonia. All right, guys, time for a knowledge check. How long after the onset of symptoms does COVID-19 typically cause dyspnea? The answer is, say it with me, 7 days. Part 3. What are the viral characteristics of COVID-19? At the center of each SARS-CoV-2 virus is the genetic material, linear, single-stranded, positive-sense RNA. The viral nucleocapsid, or N-proteins, line up like shingles that wrap up in a helical pattern, providing the scaffolding that allows the RNA to maintain its compact shape. SARS-CoV-2 is an enveloped virus, meaning that when the nucleocapsid buds out of the host cell, it wraps itself in an envelope of the phospholipid bilayer, which it takes with it. The virus adds envelope and membrane proteins, or E and M for short, that help the phospholipid bilayer maintain its structure. But the signature protein of the coronavirus family is the S, or spike protein. If you've seen a picture of a coronavirus, these are the large proteins that stick out from the surface like thumbtacks. And these are what give the virus their name in the first place, since they're evocative of the sun's rays radiating out from the virus. SARS-CoV-2 is, more specifically, a beta coronavirus, which is a genus of the coronavirus family that originated in bats. But coronaviruses range from mild to severe. To give you a clearer picture, coronaviruses caused both the SARS and MERS outbreaks, both of which were even more lethal than COVID-19. On the other hand, they're also responsible for almost one-third of the cases of common colds, so there you go. So you probably know this one. How do coronaviruses spread? Coronaviruses spread through respiratory droplets, most commonly sneezing or coughing, and less commonly through fomites, or when people touch a contaminated surface and then their eyes, mouth, or nose. Of particular debate is the significance of airborne transmission. That's where exhaled particles hover in the air for extended periods of time and cause infection, rather than simply falling to the ground like droplets. As of September 2020, it seems as though viral particles can get aerosolized if a person speaks, coughs, or sneezes, but it's not clear to what extent this actually contributes significantly to new infections. Once SARS-CoV-2 enters the upper respiratory system, the virus infects and destroys ciliated cells, resulting in inflammation. If the viral particle reaches the lungs, the virus enters the type 2 alveolar cells, where the spike proteins bind to the membrane-bound angiotensin-converting enzyme, or ACE2. We suspect that, in the early stages of COVID-19 pneumonia, this infection disrupts the ability of the type 2 alveolar cells to secrete surfactant, the phospholipid that coats the alveoli and keeps them open and available for gas exchange. Without adequate surfactant, the alveoli collapse. A minority of patients progress to severe respiratory illness, where the lungs become diffusely inflamed. On a pathology slide, these patients may have interstitial lymphocytic inflammatory infiltrates, diffuse alveolar damage, or even the classic finding of ARDS, which is hyaline membrane formation. These waxy membranes can coat the alveoli, further preventing gas exchange. The sickest patients are those that enter what we call a cytokine storm. This occurs when a whole bunch of white blood cells release inflammatory cytokines like interleukins 1 and 2 in response to the virus, leading to further activation of white blood cells in a self-propagating inflammatory cascade. We think that these are what cause the various manifestations of systemic illness in COVID-19, like septic shock and thromboembolic disease. All right, pop quiz time. COVID-19 enters the lower respiratory tract through which cells? The answer is the type 2 alveolar cells, also known as type 2 pneumocytes, by binding to the angiotensin-converting enzyme, or ACE2, receptor. Part 4. How is COVID-19 diagnosed? As with any illness, establishing a presumptive or possible diagnosis of COVID-19 starts with a focused history, emphasizing the patient's symptoms, sick contacts, and travel history. Now remind me again, what are the most common and most specific early symptoms of COVID-19? Most commonly, COVID-19 presents just like the common cold, with fever, coughs, body aches, and headache. But one of the most specific early symptoms that should definitely make you suspect COVID-19 is the loss of smell or taste. After the history is taken, a thorough physical examination is performed to look for signs of pneumonia, like coarse breath sounds or crackles. As we mentioned before, fever is very common in patients with COVID-19, but clinicians tend to focus more on whether or not the patient has an increased respiratory rate or hypoxemia, as these can be ominous signs of impending respiratory failure. Weirdly enough, many patients with COVID-19 are hypoxemic, but appear pretty comfortable with normal respirations. You may hear these patients referred to as silent hypoxemics or even happy hypoxemics. Testing for COVID-19 continues to be problematic and is a big part of the national conversation. Targeted tests for COVID-19 include nucleic acid amplification test, antigen or rapid tests, and serum antibody or serology tests. Nucleic acid amplification testing is the diagnostic test of choice. It detects the genetic material of SARS-CoV-2 in a specimen taken from the patient, usually nasopharyngeal, and processes it using reverse transcription polymerase chain reaction, or PCR. Now here's the bad news. Due to laboratory backlogs, actually processing the specimen may take long enough to where it can't realistically impact clinical decision-making, especially in the ER where I work. Furthermore, these tests are being rapidly developed and tested in real time, and therefore aren't perfect. 11 to 29% of patients may test negative despite having the disease, or a false negative. And in the United States, where multiple different private manufacturers are developing and testing these assays in their own proprietary ways, your mileage may vary. Antigen tests test for surface proteins. Since they don't require the equipment to run a polymerase chain reaction, you can actually get results in as little as 15 minutes, making it potentially a lot more useful for someone like me who doesn't have days to wait on the results. But these are much less sensitive than the nucleic acid amplification test, so you have to use your clinical judgment and estimate the pretest probability of COVID-19 when interpreting the results. Finally, blood serologic testing looks for the host's immune response to the virus by identifying IgM and IgG antibodies. The test may miss patients recently infected with COVID-19 simply because of the latency of the immune response. And as you might imagine, this is almost useless in diagnosing an acute infection, since optimal sensitivity is achieved only 3 to 4 weeks after the acute infection. It's not yet clear whether or not antibody presence means that a person has immunity to repeat infection. So as you can see, our options are crap, rapid crap, and a polished turd that we can get back after it's probably irrelevant. Therefore, clinical judgment plays a big role in diagnosing COVID-19, and if a patient has a picture-perfect story with a negative test, you should take that with a grain of salt. On a routine lab workup, a complete blood count that reveals lymphopenia, or an absolute lymphocyte count less than 1,500, is supportive of the diagnosis of COVID-19. Additionally, a number of inflammatory markers are also associated with poor prognosis, including AST, ALT, lactate dehydrogenase, C-reactive protein, D-dimer, and ferritin. A chest x-ray is commonly done to look for signs of pneumonia, and even though it's not particularly sensitive or specific, it's quick, cheap, and probably not much worse than a rapid antigen test. Findings in COVID-19 are those of atypical pneumonia, bilateral airspace opacities, usually patchy rather than lobar, with predominance in the peripheral lung fields. It's important to note, though, that the chest x-ray may be normal in earlier mild COVID-19. If you happen to know how to use it, lung ultrasound is actually more sensitive at identifying opacities as compared with the chest x-ray, and can be performed quickly at bedside. The pleura appear as a shimmering bright white line on ultrasound, and if the probe is oriented supero-inferiorly, you'll see it bordered by ribs that cast black shadows radiating away from the probe. What appear as airspace opacities on chest x-ray appear as B-lines on ultrasound, bright lines that radiate away from the probe like rays of sunshine and move with the pleura as the patient breathes. With severe enough disease, the B-lines can become wider and confluent to where, instead of individual B-lines, you instead see a single bright white shimmering sheet known as the waterfall sign between the ribs. Of note, pleural effusions are usually absent in COVID-19, no matter what imaging modality you use. Now, the catch with ultrasound is that you actually have to know how to use it. More so than with other imaging modalities, the sensitivity and specificity of bedside ultrasound depends entirely on the operator's ability to actually obtain good images in addition to interpreting them correctly. Finally, chest CT is the most sensitive and specific imaging modality for pulmonary disease. And there may be visible opacities even before symptoms occur and before the virus can be detected by PCR. But like with other imaging modalities, these findings are not specific to COVID-19. Okay, let's see what you remember about diagnostics. What is the most definitive diagnostic test for COVID-19? The answer is the nucleic acid amplification test, or PCR. Part 5. How is COVID-19 treated? The treatment of COVID-19 is a work in progress, and as of September 2020, the management of COVID-19 is still largely supportive, while waiting for the immune system to destroy the virus. But we have identified some medical therapies that do appear to improve outcomes in patients with COVID-19. And this data is cited from the U.S. National Institute of Health guidelines. First, the antiviral remdesivir appears to improve recovery time and significantly reduce mortality rate. This effect seems to be greatest in patients who require supplemental oxygen, but not high flow or positive pressure ventilation, although this may be a product of sample size. Second, the corticosteroid dexamethasone has robust data to suggest that it reduces mortality rates in hypoxic patients. It appears as though this primarily benefits the sicker end of the disease spectrum as compared to remdesivir, decreasing the rate of progression to mechanical ventilation, and even decreasing the number of days patients spend on the vent. Conversely, the NIH has recommended against its use in patients who don't require supplemental oxygen. Steroids have a wide side effect profile and increase the risk of secondary bacterial pneumonia, and have been shown to worsen outcomes in other types of viral pneumonia. And regarding hydroxychloroquine and the quinine derivatives, the NIH recommends against their use, except in a couple of ongoing trials. The studies with the best methodology do not show a mortality benefit, and there's some evidence of increased risk of adverse events. Now, media coverage has been pretty excessive regarding this medication, but the bottom line is that while the jury is not yet out on hydroxychloroquine and there are still ongoing trials, there's enough evidence for the NIH to recommend against their routine use. But it's also a little alarmist to call these dangerous drugs. Their side effect profile is not actually that excessive, especially when you compare it to some of the other medications and interventions we do on critically ill patients. Otherwise, supportive therapy for COVID-19 is much the same as in other serious viral pneumonias, and the most frequent consideration is respiratory support, given the frequency of respiratory decompensation. Hypoxia is managed with supplemental oxygen as needed, and can be escalated to non-invasive positive pressure ventilation strategies like high-flow nasal cannula or BiPAP. Endotracheal intubation with mechanical ventilation may be used if a patient is unable to adequately oxygenate or breathe off carbon dioxide, even with non-invasive ventilation. Having patients regularly switch from lying supine to lying prone, known as proning, may increase oxygen saturation by increasing alveolar recruitment and moving blood to better ventilated portions of the lung. Finally, mechanical cardiopulmonary support with extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, or ECMO, is a last resort in patients that fail even conventional mechanical ventilation, and this is actually a pretty cool trick. It's basically heart-lung bypass that keeps you oxygenated and keeps your blood moving while your lungs have a chance to heal. Septic shock is managed with antipyretics like acetaminophen and vasopressors like norepinephrine and dopamine. Of note, these patients should not receive the large volume fluid boluses that most septic patients get. COVID-19 patients are extremely susceptible to pulmonary edema, and fluids should be administered cautiously while monitoring for respiratory decompensation. Critically ill patients with COVID-19 are at high risk for hypercoagulability, especially pulmonary embolism. And that's a problem, especially since one might easily attribute worsening respiratory failure and shock to pneumonia and sepsis respectively. A good rule of thumb is that any abrupt decompensation should prompt a workup for a pulmonary embolism. And some hospitals are actually instituting protocols to empirically treat high-risk patients with full therapeutic doses of anticoagulants. Finally, potentially nephrotoxic medications such as NSAIDs, acyclovir, and prolonged aminoglycosides are avoided in critically ill patients with COVID-19, since these patients actually have a higher risk than expected of developing acute kidney injury. All right, guys, time for a knowledge check. What medical therapies are currently indicated for COVID-19? As of September 2020, remdesivir and dexamethasone are the only medications routinely indicated in the treatment of COVID-19. Part 6. How is COVID-19 prevented? Despite the concerted efforts of governments and the pharmaceutical industry, as of September 2020, there is no fully tested vaccine for COVID-19. So the best way to tackle the virus is by preventing its spread. Many public health measures have been recommended to help break the transmission cycle. These are time-tested parts of the epidemiologist's bag of tricks, and most of them are just common sense. 1. Social distancing, keeping at least 6 feet or 2 meters away from others, which is the theoretical limit of respiratory droplet spread. Not only that, but if you have the option, just stay home and avoid non-essential gatherings, since that 6-foot rule only applies if people aren't coughing, talking, and if airborne transmission isn't a thing, which is a whole lot of ifs. 2. Wear a mask. Wearing a mask or other face covering is recommended to decrease the risk of virus transmission, and there's actually decent data behind this. An N95 mask will protect you from airborne transmission, and a fluid-resistant surgical mask will protect you from most respiratory droplets, but since it doesn't really seal against your face, it's not foolproof. What the World Health Organization recommends for everyone who goes outdoors is a non-medical cloth mask. It's not likely to protect you, but it reduces the number of respiratory droplets that you spew out of your mouth every time you open it. Plus, it saves the medical-grade masks for us folks on the front lines who deliberately walk into rooms where we get coughed on by COVID patients. You're welcome. 3. Isolation and quarantine. These refer to similar practices for different patient demographics. You isolate people who have tested or are presumed COVID-19 positive, and you quarantine asymptomatic patients who have had exposure risks. If a patient is asymptomatic, it usually makes sense to quarantine them and their entire family, whereas if a patient's symptomatic, you need to try and separate them from your family as well. But in both cases, the magic number is 14 days. For patients in isolation, that's 14 days after the onset of symptoms, and for patients being quarantined, that's 14 days after the exposure. But the timer resets if they become symptomatic. And finally, everyone needs to be more diligent than ever about personal protection and hygiene. Regular hand washing and use of hand sanitizers is recommended, especially after touching surfaces in public. And stop touching your face! Don't touch your eyes, mouth, or nose because those act as portals for viral entry. Honestly, I find that like 50% of the benefit of wearing a mask is that it stops people from compulsively rubbing at their nose or the corner of their mouth. Now, if you live in the United States, where there's a strong culture of rugged individualism, you probably know that asking people to do this stuff for weeks or months on end is a pretty tough sell. But it's not just cultural. Self-isolation and quarantine require a certain amount of social support and financial independence that not everyone has. But we all have a responsibility to at least make the pitch, because the more people we can convince to do the right thing, the more we can slow the spread of disease and prevent a spike in the number of cases. This approach has been referred to as flattening the curve. If we don't flatten the curve, a sharp increase in COVID-19 cases could overwhelm healthcare systems, especially the need for intensive care beds and ventilators, as we saw in Italy. Not only will doctors and nurses be forced to make decisions as to who gets treated and who doesn't, but the healthcare system will get so jammed up with COVID-19 that we won't be able to treat other stuff, like heart attacks and trauma. Elective surgeries like cancer surgeries will be put off with no end date in sight. Overworked doctors and nurses will get sloppy with their PPE, and when we get sloppy, we get sick and taken out of the already insufficient workforce. And some of us will die. So yeah, even if you're not yet on the front lines, you can still make this pitch to everyone you hear who tries to blow off the pandemic. But have compassion for those whose social and financial situations don't allow them to adhere to best practices, and help them do the best they can. Part 7. Prognosis and social effects. Precise mortality rates for COVID-19 are kind of hard to determine, because the lack of widespread testing in most countries, including the USA, prevents a true estimate of disease prevalence. And you can't know what percent of patients die until you know how many they were to begin with. Studies from various countries have reported mortality rates as high as 14%, But perhaps the best indicators are countries like South Korea that test and trace cases extensively. They've reported a lower mortality rate of 0.9%, but it's also worth noting that the robust public health practices probably also legitimately improved outcomes by rapidly identifying and isolating cases, finding sick patients early in the disease, and prioritizing care for the high-risk patients. COVID-19 isn't the most lethal infection we've encountered. Both SARS and Ebola kill a higher percentage of those infected, and the HIV pandemic, which is currently in its fifth decade, has killed far more people in terms of gross numbers. But the combination of virulence, lethality, infectiousness, and percentage of asymptomatic carriers have caused disruptions to health systems and economies that is unprecedented in living memory, probably since the Spanish flu. In addition to the financial burdens of isolation and quarantine, school closures have meant that patients are caring for their children at home, which can make working difficult to impossible. Governments around the world have shut down non-essential workplaces, creating mass unemployment and financial hardship. And while I may kvetch about having to inhale people's COVID fumes all day long, at least I have a job that's not going anywhere anytime soon. Often, the poor and immigrant populations that are least equipped to deal with financial hardship are disproportionately affected. Finally, routine medical and dental care has slowed substantially during the pandemic, which may have significant effects on the overall health of populations in the years to come. And in societies with enforced social distancing, the loss of social support has led to a lot of concerns about the effects on mental health. Knowledge is power, and with it, you can join in the fight against COVID-19 misinformation. So let's see what you learned. First, can you distinguish between coronavirus, SARS-CoV-2, and COVID-19? COVID-19 is the disease caused by SARS-CoV-2, a specific strain of the coronavirus family, which likely became a pandemic by crossing over from animals to humans in late 2019. Second, can you describe the viral characteristics of COVID-19? SARS-CoV-2 is an enveloped, linear, single-stranded, positive-sense RNA virus with a helical capsid. Its envelope is studded with the characteristic spike proteins that help it bind to cells and give the coronavirus family their classic appearance and name. Third, do you know how coronavirus spreads? Transmission occurs via respiratory droplets and through contaminated surfaces. Next, can you describe the typical clinical presentation of a patient with COVID-19? Most patients present with a non-specific flu-like illness with symptoms like fever, cough, myalgias, and headache. The most specific symptoms of COVID-19 are the loss of smell and taste and the development of dyspnea about 7 days after the onset of symptoms. 7 days. Unfortunately, many patients are asymptomatic, which facilitates the spread of the disease. Next, what categories of specific, targeted tests for COVID-19 are currently available? Gold standard diagnosis is made by nucleic acid amplification test using PCR. There's also a less sensitive rapid antigen test, as well as an antibody test that reaches peak sensitivity about 3 to 4 weeks after the infection. Next, what medical therapies have proven beneficial in the treatment of COVID-19 as of September 2020? Remdesivir decreases the duration of illness and mortality in patients who require oxygen, but not high-level ventilatory support, or ECMO. Dexamethasone decreases mortality and need for mechanical ventilation in sicker patients, but is not recommended for people that don't require oxygen. Finally, what public health strategies can help stop the spread of COVID-19? The general population should practice social distancing, wear masks in public places, avoid touching the mucous membranes, and practice meticulous hand hygiene. Symptomatic or known COVID-positive patients should self-isolate for 14 days after the onset of symptoms. Asymptomatic patients with exposure risks should self-quarantine for 14 days after the exposure. Now, armed with your newfound knowledge, let's get back to our patient from the beginning of the episode. A 25-year-old male presents to an urgent care center with 4 days of symptoms consistent with COVID-19, but no evidence of respiratory distress or hypoxia. How will you proceed with workup and management? Pause the audio if you need some time to think. You order a chest x-ray, which reveals subtle bilateral airspace opacities, and basic labs, which reveal a normal white count with decreased lymphocytes. While both findings support your suspicions, you tell the patient that the gold standard is the COVID-19 nasopharyngeal swab, which you send for PCR testing. But since the patient does not require oxygen and has no respiratory distress, neither medication nor hospital admission is likely to be of benefit. The patient appears irritated that the test results won't come back today. "Will they at least call me if the results are negative so I can get back to work?" he growls. You shake your head sadly and explain to him that, given his classic presentation for COVID-19 and how inconsistent current tests are, you worry that a negative result has a high chance of being a false negative. Since he's had symptoms for 4 days already, he must self-isolate for another 10 days before he can return to work. "Then what the hell was the point of even sticking that thing up my nose?" he explodes angrily. You remind him of a county alert 2 weeks ago, of the hundreds of tests that were required to warn citizens of a local spike in cases. You acknowledge his financial struggles, but ask him to think of his coworkers, especially the older ones, who might suffer if he went back to work too early. In a pandemic, you tell him, we all have to do our part to take care of each other. Otherwise, it'll be a long time before things go back to normal. His expression softens, and he says that his ex-wife can take care of the kids. "Oh, and one more thing," you tell him. "About 3 days from now, you may start getting short of breath. If you do, get yourself to the emergency department as fast as you can." And that's our show. Make sure to like and subscribe if you like what you heard. And remember, your feedback helps us improve. You can enjoy the full Brix experience online at www.usmle-rx.com, complete with illustrations, questions, flashcards, and active learning. So go check that out if you haven't already. Until next time, stay healthy, stay safe, and spread the word.